Hello and welcome. A single event can define a person. Birth, illness, war, death. Those are a few of the more significant ones. But how about eating a peanut butter sandwich? For Heather Fraser, a Toronto-based writer, author, and educator, it was peanut butter that turned her life upside down. In 1995, her one-year-old son, Woody, sitting calmly in his high chair, took one bite of the toast with peanut butter his mom had prepared for him and immediately developed a severe allergic reaction that sent Heather into panic mode, rushing her son to the emergency room. He survived after aggressive medical intervention, was diagnosed with peanut allergy, and sent home. Forced to keep her son away from even the odor of peanut, Ms. Fraser began to research this strange phenomenon, and her years of study has produced the first ever historical account of the rise of peanut allergy in Western society, The History of the Peanut Allergy Epidemic. Heather Fraser joins us today from Toronto. Heather, thanks for taking the time out to discuss your book.
Hi, thanks, Dave.
Heather, tell us a bit about what happened with your son Woody and his first peanut reaction.
Well, as you said, when he was a year old, that was in 1995. Indeed, I used to enjoy eating peanut butter for breakfast, as many people do.
Right.
And it was just a regular day, and I gave him a small bite of toast with peanut butter on it, and the response in this child was so fast, I'd never seen anything like it. He began to turn red, and then mosquito bite-sized hives emerged over his face and his body, and these spots grew very quickly and joined with each other, so you ended up with this angry red scar that started to move over his body. The eyelids, the lips began to swell, and it was just so fast,
right,
so violent, and I had no idea what it was at that time. And of course, we flew to the emergency room, and when I'd announced to the nurses at the triage that we'd eaten peanut butter, they just moved like lightning and hooked him up to the drugs, and thankfully, happily, it all worked, and he was saved.
I can't imagine what you were going through.
I was just stunned. I didn't know what it was, but when they explained it to me afterwards, and then we went to see an allergy doctor, and we had blood tests that told us, indeed, he was allergic to peanuts and tree nuts, that then you had to carry an EpiPen with you, which is an emergency auto-injection of epinephrine, a drug that will then calm the reaction and give you an opportunity to get to the hospital at that point. And every year we go for tests, and every year it comes back, he's just incredibly sensitive to peanuts and nuts.
And you discovered that the peanut allergy epidemic really only affected Western society, like the United States, the United Kingdom, Canada, and Australia. Is that right?
At first, it appeared to be that way to doctors about a decade ago, where it didn't seem that China had peanut allergy, or India, or most of Africa. And that's an important clue. But most recently, it has emerged in Singapore and Hong Kong, where you've got 1% of children, school-age kids now, exhibiting peanut allergy. But that long ago, 10 years or so, I think that's an important clue as well. And I mentioned in the book that there was a sudden acceleration of the allergy just in children and just in those certain countries around the year 1990. And I did some digging, and I found that ER records, emergency room records, eyewitness accounts, and cohort studies, which are studies of groups of kids all the same age, born in the same time frame. These all pointed to the fact that you had a sudden increase in peanut allergy around 1990, and that was an important clue to what might be happening. And then you'd go back and you think, well, what could possibly have affected just children, just in those countries at that particular time?
And Woody experienced something called anaphylaxis, is that right?
That is what it's called, and it's the most severe form of allergy.
And what is it exactly? What is anaphylaxis?
It's a word that was created well over 100 years ago by a doctor when he recognized it in his research. And today we understand it to be a condition where the body has produced a certain kind of antibody designed to protect it against a particular protein that has managed to get into the bloodstream. The body will automatically, naturally do this. And when you have high levels of these antibodies in your blood, and the doctor will measure your blood with a RASP test, and he'll actually give you a number that will tell you how sensitive you are. And then further, when you're exposed, if you're sensitive to a peanut or dairy or some other substance, then when you are exposed to that food, hopefully accidentally, that these antibodies will rally to defend you. And it's a very strange kind of a defense, because what happens is that the body releases a substance called histamine. And what that does is it makes the body swell and causes the itching, the hives. It can also, the body can respond with vomiting, diarrhea, and blood pressure will drop. There are a number of symptoms that go along with anaphylaxis that are indeed life-threatening.
Right. And of course, anaphylaxis, as you point out in your book, comes from the two Greek words, ana, which means against, and phylaxis, which means protection. And you mentioned before proteins. Mm-hmm. It's the proteins that are problematic. Is that right?
Yes, they discovered that over 100 years ago, that when a protein manages to bypass your lines of defense, get through the skin, and even bypass your digestive system, if you're unable to fully digest a protein and it manages somehow to escape into the bloodstream, this is where the body will naturally, as I mentioned, produce these antibodies. So it has to get into the bloodstream in order for this condition to be created. And then the question, I guess, becomes, well, how today, in terms of an epidemic, how would these proteins, even trace proteins, you don't need very much at all, how are these getting into the bloodstream?
Right.
And there's only a limited number of ways that it possibly can, and one is through ingestion, of course. You can eat it, and it can manage somehow. If you have very weak digestion, you can have particles that float through the body and can access the bloodstream. You can inhale it, as people who have pollen allergy would know, and it can go through the skin with injection. That's another proven way, and this is how, that many years ago, 100 years ago, the word anaphylaxis was coined by a doctor who was injecting dogs with a vaccine that he believed would protect them from a particular poison. He was doing experiments, and the first injection actually produced, he believed, a level of tolerance in the dogs. But the second injection, he produced something he didn't expect, and that was a violent reaction that killed the dogs very quickly. And this was the Dr. Richet, who created the word anaphylaxis, and actually in 1913 won the Nobel Prize for his understanding of the condition. And he was very clear, you can read online his acceptance speech for the Nobel Prize, that it's very difficult to create anaphylaxis in a mammal with healthy digestion.
Right.
He did try, but what he did in understanding food anaphylaxis, food allergy, is that he would actually take trace proteins of meat and dairy, and he injected it into the bloodstreams of various animals, dogs, rabbits, cats, horses, and he created anaphylaxis in all of these animals to prove that this is how it can be created.
It could be created, but it's not really naturally occurring, right?
In history, people who have been stung by bees would develop, because that's an injection, would develop potentially a reaction, anaphylaxis to that venom. And in history, it has been created very, very rarely, though. As I mentioned, and
right,
as Richet pointed out in his research, if you have weak digestion and these proteins manage to get into your blood through the digestive system, then it can also be created. But prior to the 20th century, it was very rare that you would have this happen, this
right,
level of reactivity. Well, going specifically to the peanut and my understanding of how and why this has become epidemic in children, I went back in time to find whether anaphylaxis had ever occurred in an epidemic level in children. And it had. At the turn of the century, there was a condition known as serum sickness that affected thousands of children following the vaccination with diphtheria antitoxin. And this was a very novel, I mean, from the present, you know, we're used to vaccination. It's like going for your child's first haircut. But at the time, it was a revolutionary technology where they paired a vaccine with the needle. It had never happened before. And that was in 1895. And subsequent to that, of course, they were vaccinating children with the idea of protecting them. You had many children that fell ill with symptoms that a particular pediatrician, his name was Clemens von Fricke, identified. He identified these symptoms of serum sickness, which included hives, itching, vomiting, shock, and sometimes death. He identified and saw that those symptoms were similar to those he saw in his practice, where people became sensitized to pollens and bee stings.
Okay.
And he was the man who came up with the word allergy or altered reactivity to describe these symptoms. This was the first epidemic of an allergic phenomenon in Western history.
Because of vaccinations.
because of the vaccinations, they didn't realize at that time that it was the proteins that were in the serum. And this serum, diphtheria, which was one of the first that came out and was applied en masse to children, it was actually made from the blood of horses. And they produced millions of doses of this diphtheria antitoxin and were injecting it into hundreds of thousands of children. And they ended up with this, unbeknownst to them, they you know, certainly this wasn't a deliberate event, but they discovered very quickly that it was indeed the proteins in the serum that had caused this epidemic. Of course, very quickly, they moved to purify the sera and the vaccines from then on to remove as much protein as possible. As technologies improved, indeed, serum sickness diminished.
As you say in your book, mass allergic phenomena emerged as a side effect of a late 19th century technology of vaccination. So prior to vaccinations, which started at the end of the 19th century, there was no such thing as a mass allergic phenomena. That's clear, right?
That's very clear. There was no such thing. It was very rare to have anaphylaxis, that severe form. People did have allergies to pollens, for example, and foods, but it was very rare that you would have this level, this severity. And today, certainly, I mean, it would have been unheard of that you would have 2% of all school-age children. And today, that's 1.6 million children in the U.S. Recently, stats come out where they've identified peanut tree nut allergy in that many children.
Okay. Now, let's fast forward a little bit. From the late 19th century to around now. Why peanuts? Why are peanuts in vaccines?
That's a good question. That was one of the first ones I asked. And so, again, I went back in time because those are the skills that I have, historical research, and I found that peanut allergy did not actually exist. I couldn't find mention of it before the close of World War II. So about 1947, I looked at the medical literature and I found that there were several articles regarding small outbreaks of peanut allergy in children who were taking part in studies of injected penicillin.
Okay.
Why that was, I mean, penicillin was brand new at the end of World War II, and it was called the Wonder Drug. But the problem with the Wonder Drug was that one injection of it would last only for an hour, and it would be excreted by the kidneys very quickly. So an army doctor by the name of Romanski came up with an invention whereby he mixed the penicillin with peanut oil and beeswax and then injected that. It looked like sort of a buttery substance. It was a little bit thick, and it was hard to inject, apparently, but injected they did, and they found that penicillin levels in the bloodstream could be maintained for 24 hours, which was amazing and wonderful because then, you know, penicillin was used to cure all kinds of infections.
So Romanski used peanuts, and there were a lot of reasons, as you explain in your book, why peanuts. It was cottonseed oil that was used prior to peanuts, but for a variety of reasons, peanuts came and replaced cottonseed oil.
There were many oils, I'm sure they tried, and they found that cottonseed, I guess, must have been at the time a good, accessible, plentiful kind of a substance to use with injections. But how did peanut oil come into this? During the war, of course, the oils that were available were very limited. But the one oil that was available in great quantities was peanut. And it wasn't rationed. It was the only food that wasn't rationed during World War II. A good reason for that was that they needed the oil, which they turned into glycerin, for use in explosives. And they put aside many acres of land just for peanuts. You know, as you can imagine, other oils that they might have used were blocked from import during the war. And so Romanski looked around and he found that peanut oil was just available. And he'd intended to mix it with the penicillin with the idea that it would be injected into hundreds of thousands of people.
What does the peanut oil actually do when mixed with the penicillin?
Keep in mind it's a refined peanut oil that, again, being conscious of the proteins that they might be injecting into people, they tried to reduce that as much as possible as well. And the reason that his formula worked was that the oil and the beeswax would coat the particles of penicillin, and so that when they are injected, the body would slowly metabolize the oil and allow for a slow release of the penicillin into the bloodstream.
Okay. Now, peanuts have been described as a perfect allergen. Why is that, Heather?
Doctors have been looking closely, of course, at the peanut to find out if there's something that makes it different from other foods, makes it more allergenic. And they did discover that it is very hard to break down the proteins of the peanut, as in the case of refined peanut oil, where you still have traces of intact proteins. And they looked at the structure specifically of these proteins to find out what makes them so durable. And they found just simply that it's almost like they're welded together in a way. And even by digestion, they find that it is very hard to break them down. They're very resistant.
Okay. Somehow, these geniuses pick peanuts, which have a lot of properties and characteristics that would define the peanut as the perfect allergen to use in vaccinations. And it's clear from your research and others' research that there were no mass allergic reactions in the public in the United States and elsewhere until vaccinations began. And of course, the word vaccination comes from, as you explain in your book on page 83, vaca, which comes from the word cow. Is that right?
Oh, we're jumping way back in history. The first vaccinations did not use a needle, an injection. It hadn't been invented yet. It used a lancet, which is a pronged tool, which is used to scratch the skin. And in those early days, there was only one type of vaccination, and that was for smallpox.
Right.
And anyway, they would apply eventually a type of mixture that was for smallpox taken from cows. And it was cowpox that was related to smallpox. And they found when you put the pus of a cow that had cowpox onto scratched skin, that in fact it would make some people protected from smallpox. And it was an English country doctor named Jenner who discovered this to be the fact using volunteers. And then he would subsequently apply a smallpox liquid onto these scratches on the skin. And when people didn't contract smallpox, this was hugely revolutionary. And this is where they made, at that time in history, which is about 1800, when they made vaccination in many countries mandatory, and they would have children in particular vaccinated against smallpox. And one can understand, because it is the most frightening. If you ever read accounts or see anyone with this disease, it is truly frightening, and you can understand why someone would take the chance of some adverse response to that. I mean, you weigh the risks, and you make your decision based on the conditions that you're in at the time. And it's hard to put ourselves back in that moment, but a lot of people went for the vaccination. It gave them a better chance.
Right, and this was 1798 that you're talking about.
About 1800, that's right. But when it was about the middle of the 1800s, around 1864 or something like that, a couple of men in Europe devised the hypodermic syringe because they found that it made morphine, for example, more potent. You could inject it directly into the bloodstream with using just a small amount of it, as opposed to ingesting it. If you were to eat it, the effect of it is much less because it's modified by the digestive system.
Right, by the digestive enzymes. Is this the reason why people are becoming so allergic to vaccinations, because refined peanut oil is in the vaccinations and it's bypassing the digestive enzymes?
That is what I suggest in the book, absolutely. And in tracing the actual use of the peanut oil and refined peanut oil, again, doctors are very conscious of these proteins. And so they go to great lengths to make sure that the oil, which is used in adjuvants, and I'll get that to a minute about what that is in a vaccine, that it is highly refined to reduce the protein as much as possible and to inject it not into the bloodstream, but deep into the muscle so that the body has an opportunity to metabolize the oils and the ingredients that are in a vaccine, and to eliminate the waste afterwards, because a vaccine will include not just the oils, but a lot of other toxic elements that you may or may not be aware of, and they are under no obligation to tell you, but you can get sort of a short list of ingredients, and it might include something like formaldehyde, certainly would include aluminum, by times it would include, of course, mercury, and other things you would never expect, including antibiotics and human cells as well. And I'm not a doctor, I don't know what all these components are for. My concern was to look back at, well, did peanut oil make its way into the vaccines after the antibiotics? Indeed, it did become sort of general practice because of the success with penicillin. It then became sort of an obvious thing to include in other things, and they began to include it in vaccines and baby formula and vitamin pills and anesthetics that you would use at the hospital and any other areas that we wouldn't expect it to be in, but it came into general use because studies were done and they gave this particular oil, the refined oil, GRAS status, G-R-A-S, which is generally recognized as safe.
Right. And what you said was, I just want to make sure that I understood it properly, that in the United States, it's not mandatory for these companies to include the ingredients of the vaccines on their label?
I can speak for peanut oil only in that instance. And refined peanut oil and refined soybean oil, by law, you don't have to include it on a label, whether that label is a food or whether it's a drug, because it is believed to be safe. And you can go to the CDC website, and they've got all kinds of literature there about that very issue. But they will admit that they do say, in fact, that there are trace proteins in the highly refined oil that is used, peanut oil, highly refined peanut oil that is used in medications whether they're injected or whether they're taken orally. But they say highly refined. It begs the question, is there a lowly refined?
Right.
So they do talk about different grades of oils. So it becomes a little bit gray.
The American Peanut Council probably has a lot to do with the grayness of that.
Mm-hmm. I don't know exactly what elements and lobby efforts are involved in making all of these decisions. In the UK, however, very recently they've questioned the safety of including refined peanut oil in injectables or other things in foods because they found that people have been reacting to them, people who are sensitive to them. And so they've suggested, they've got guidelines in the UK and England, for example, where the manufacturer is encouraged to include these on the label, encouraged strongly.
Just encouraged.
But there is, and I asked this specifically, are there laws that force them to put this on? And no, there are no laws. In fact, the guidelines are in conflict with corporate law, where they are protected, their ingredients, their formula are protected from public scrutiny, and they're exempted from the Freedom of Information Act. You can't find out exactly what's in there. But if you search a patent, if you go backwards and you go to a doctor and you say, well, we had this vaccine, get the name of it, you can find it. It's amazing. The internet is just incredible, the amount of information that can be at our fingertips. If you want to know something,
yes,
you can find out if you want to know badly enough. And there are patents out there that you can search, and you can find out about adjuvants, for example. And that kind of takes me back to the earlier bit that I was wanting to explain.
Right.
In 1964, in the New York Times, there was this article that exclaimed in the headline, peanut oil included in new vaccine. It's going to revolutionize vaccination. And they started with the flu vaccine, where they would use this adjuvant, which typically contains aluminum and an oil, an emulsified oil. And the oil that they chose, and this would be public record, so I can probably say this, it was Merck. It came out with something called Adjuvant 65. And it included in it, amongst other things, a refined peanut oil. It doesn't say refined in the article, but I'm assuming it was.
Mm-hmm.
And a form of aluminum. And the adjuvant.
What is an adjuvant?
We're using a Latin Greek terminology, and it's additive. It just means an additive.
Okay.
And they add this mixture of aluminum and peanut oil, in this instance, the adjuvant 65, into a vaccine to provoke the body into producing high levels of antibodies, which is what doctors and researchers are always looking for in any vaccine. They will measure the blood afterwards and find out what levels of antibodies have been produced by a particular vaccine. And this is where they deem something to be very successful. But they always have to balance the effectiveness of a vaccine with the levels of toxicity and the potential risk for adverse events that can happen when you increase the potency. You've got to watch for that. And in all of the medical literature about adjuvants, you will find that they make this compromise, they make this decision for the consumers. And they decide, well, you know, is it important to have an adjuvanted vaccine in this instance? Well, often it is, and they began to include this particular adjuvant with peanut oil, starting in flus, and then it moved into other vaccines through the 60s and the 70s. And in 1973, you find that there is the first formal U.S. study of peanut allergy in children. Enough children had become allergic to this one food that doctors decided, well, it was time to study and find out what was happening. And they watched the peanut allergy increase through the 70s, coincidental to the additive of peanut oil adjuvant in the vaccine, through the 70s and through the 80s, and you would have sporadic deaths. Now, the media didn't take close interest in this until there were deaths of young people. And what really turned the media in favor of doing more research into what is happening here was the death of a national U.S. squash champion, an 18-year-old, who ate a spoonful of chili that had been thickened with peanut butter.
Wow.
And it just so shocked and surprised everyone that this is where you start to get some serious attention in the media, and that was about 1986. So just to take a slight step back, after,
sure.
You know, you've got these amazing, excited exclamations in the New York Times about the use of peanut oil in vaccines, and then you had more in the late 60s, a couple more articles that came out, that you don't see that kind of excited admission, exploration of ingredients in the public media after that. In the 70s, they started to have a number of lawsuits that came up that really did a lot of damage to vaccine makers.
Right. That's actually where I was hoping to go, because you said that the death of that sports figure was in 1986. And of course, in your book on page 130, you explain that in this litigious environment, which you're talking about right now, that many pharmaceutical companies simply abandoned the vaccine market. And then in 1986, President Reagan, he signed the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act. And beginning in 86, that pretty much set the stage for the peanut allergy epidemic. Can you explain how that happened?
The act actually prevented parents who believed their children had been damaged by vaccines from going directly after vaccine makers. It meant that they had to satisfy the government requirements and their questions and, you know, how damaged are you and what kinds and so on. So you had to satisfy them before you were allowed to take any kind of further legal action against vaccine makers. And that was a great relief to them because even Merck, there is an internal report, I've got a book about the history of Merck, where they considered in 1979 leaving the vaccine market as well. But they didn't, of course, but they thought about it very seriously. So at that time, around that time, you ended up with just a few vaccine makers and the government getting very worried about, will we have enough vaccines? We're sort of under siege here. And, you know, not only are people very upset and suing vaccine makers, we've got vaccine makers leaving the market. We've got to take some action. So they stop parents from having the ability to directly seek retribution or satisfaction against the makers. And they decided as well that they would change the program. And it's just the most amazing sort of perfect storm of legal, economic, political forces that came together around this time, around 1986,
right,
where the U.S. government and, of course, Canada followed suit. Everybody just followed what the Americans did in conjunction with recommendations from the World Health Organization, where they decided, well, not only are we under siege from not maybe having enough vaccines, but parents are now, they realize, well, parents aren't vaccinating their kids before school. So you've got all these toddlers, young people under the age of 5, who've not been vaccinated. The numbers were quite staggering. There were just 30%, I think, or something of that nature at that time of children under 5 that actually were vaccinated. And even then, they didn't go for their full schedule. So they decided they would create new programs and new laws whereby they would start vaccinating young people. And at that time, they decided that they would create, this is the IOM, Institute of Medicine in the U.S., where they set up kind of a prioritization of what they believed were the most important vaccines to produce and to address in children under the age of 5.
Okay.
And the one that floated to the top of that list was the HIB, H-I-B-B, which is the influenza B, which is a bacteria that will potentially in some children cause meningitis. So this was a very big concern. Meningitis in children was actually declining. It was on the decline about 8% a year. But when they introduced the HIB vaccine, well, suddenly they had 48% decline in this particular disease in children. But what occurred at this time, where you've got all these factors happening at the same time, is that they introduced the HIB with a number of other vaccines. They rolled them all together in kind of a one injection with 5 vaccines in it.
Right.
And they did this very, very quickly. And why did they need it to do that quickly without the benefit of longitudinal studies? I can only refer back to the political situation at the time and the decisions made by the powers that be at the CDC and infectious disease and the people at that time. And there's so many forces, and they were international. They weren't just American. And they're very concerned to vaccinate children under the age of 5. And so this is what they did and really started to apply this to children around 1990, or just prior to 1990, 88, I think they really started to set the programs in motion. And coincidentally,
right,
you have the rise, dramatic rise, suddenly in 1990 of peanut allergy just in children.
Coincidentally.
Coincidentally, and food allergy and a number of other conditions sort of outside the scope of my book that suddenly accelerated just in children and just at this time.
So this was 86 when Reagan signed the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act, and then a few years later, the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program. And of course, as you said, they changed the law to protect the vaccine makers and put parents at the disadvantage. And then in 1991, Bush won. They took action, you say on page 131, on a goal of raising national vaccination levels to 90% by the year 2000. And again, they did all this very quickly. And on page 137, this is remarkable here, because the reasons that the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention gave for combining the vaccines, none of the reasons were about the effectiveness of the vaccine. But they said, one, combination vaccines reduce the number of injections. 2, improve vaccination timeliness and coverage. And 3, reduced shipping and storage costs. How about the effectiveness of the vaccine, or why we're giving the vaccine to begin with? It seems like the CDC was concerned with protecting the economic interests of the vaccine industry.
it's an interesting moment in history, and I don't know that we'll look back, you know, many years from now and we'll say, what were we thinking? We look back 100 years ago to when they first started vaccination and the event that followed from a lack of understanding of the simple fact that we know now that proteins in the vaccine would create allergy and anaphylaxis in the population that was being targeted within children.
But it's big business, Heather, isn't it?
The World Health Organization described the HIP vaccine in particular as a blockbuster.
Right.
And to use that kind of a term, instead of focusing on the health of the children, you know, is there a connection between the rise of adverse effects and conditions just in children
right. In
the last 20 years and the most profound procedure that is used just on children, on almost every child in the U.S. and Canada and the Western world from the age of 2 months in Canada, but, you know, they have other vaccines that they apply the second that you come out of the womb in the U.S. But I say it's coincidental because there are no large population studies of unvaccinated versus vaccinated people in the U.S.
Right.
There are a couple of Congress people that annually come to Congress with a bill. Carolyn Maloney and Christopher Smith. It's almost mm-hmm. like an annual ritual. They come and they ask for money and they say, we really need to have this done. It would satisfy a lot of thoughts and concerns and worries on this point. And every year they are just, I guess, they're just ignored. I don't know what happens behind those doors. I have a copy of the letter from 2009 that they submitted. It's just dead silence from that. You'd think that this being a huge concern for now 25% of parents in the U.S. thinking that vaccination has caused autism, surely this would put an end to it if vaccines are indeed completely safe, as we're being told that they are.
Right.
But even the IOM attempted a study kind of looking at the literature that is there, and they couldn't make up their minds. They couldn't make a firm decision on this because they didn't have this unvaccinated versus vaccinated population study.
And that's their reason for not doing anything is because they don't have the study.
Right.
Are they going to do it, you think?
The IOM doesn't have the power, I guess, within their, whatever their mandate is, that they're not the body to do it. They should be. I don't know.
But they can't. Legally, they can't.
Legally, they can't. I guess that's the point. But I'm sure the information exists that they would have followed many children over whatever period of time to determine, you know, what kind of outcomes there are. And pharmaceutical companies, this is their business. They need to know what's happening with their products.
Right. But the pharmaceutical lobby is very powerful.
Enormously, mind-bogglingly.
Right. As you bring up the point in your book on page 163, you say the massive rise in chronic degenerative conditions in children has made money for investors in pharmaceutical stocks as well. One market analyst suggested that given the explosion in allergy in children, that an autoimmune index would be a useful tool for investors, almost like the S&P 500 index. So perhaps doctors are stumped, but they don't mind being stumped because they're not calling the shots. Their employers are calling the shots. They're telling the doctors what to do. The lobbyists of the pharmaceutical industries are telling the government what they want done. And the parents simply don't have a lobby. And the number one rule of political science is that a small organized force will always defeat a large disorganized one.
In terms of the money, parents sort of functioning in the dark here, not knowing what's causing these conditions. They just see them massively increasing and not knowing, referring back to the doctor, asking him. And as you say, you've got all these relationships that are cemented together. And then there's the parent who goes to the doctor. They have the shot. They end up with something adverse. And like myself, they think and research and wonder and conclude, well, maybe it's the vaccinations. Well, it doesn't matter because you can't prove it. You are left to absorb the cost of this damage that you think might be caused by vaccination, but you have no way of proving it.
Right. So to summarize, these type of mass allergic reactions did not exist prior to vaccinations, number one. Number two, when cottonseed oil fell out of favor for a variety of reasons, which are detailed in your fine book, and was replaced for a variety of reasons by peanuts, and then added by Romanski into the penicillin vaccine for a variety of reasons. On top of that, in the mid-80s, when the vaccination schedule for young children changed, became very aggressive, that created the situation where we're at now. Is that right?
I think that is a good summary of what I've put in the book. I think that timeline is quite accurate.
It's such a fine book, and there's so much information that we didn't get to talk about that I would love to talk about. This should be required reading for not just every parent, but everybody. Heather Fraser, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Dave.